You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. So welcome to episode 278, and I chat with Ava Edds. Ava is a licensed professional counsellor, and in it we specifically talk about loved ones of those with OCD. So firstly we talk about her therapy story, and then we talk about caregiver burnout, how to prevent caregiver burnout, self-care, understanding your loved one's experience of OCD, understanding accommodation, how the loved one can help the person with OCD, self-compassion, values, and much, much more. So if you are a loved one of someone with OCD, I think this episode will help you. And if you're someone with OCD and you think your loved one could benefit from this, please do share it with them. And thanks as always to NoCD for supporting the show and the work that we do. NoCD are now operating in Australia as well as UK and USA. So good work to NoCD for continuing their expansion. And thank you to them for sponsoring the show. And if you want to find out more, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. So thank you to you guys, as always, for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Ava. Welcome to the show, Ava.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Thank you. It's good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no worries. And as you know, I always like, if I get a therapist on, I like to hear their therapy story. So, you know, what got them into being a therapist and then also working with OCD specifically?
Sure, yeah. So for me, I think as far as I can remember, I have always been really, really interested in, you know, just people's behavior and why people behave the way that they do. Me as a child, I was a very, very anxious child. I would always worry about all the worst case scenarios, any possible thing that could happen. A lot of social anxiety, a lot of just kind of worry and rumination. That was a very central theme in my life. And I think, you know, up until adulthood as well, it's not something that you just kind of get rid of, right? Like occasionally you find yourself worrying and ruminating about things. And even if you know how to deal with it, you know, sometimes it does take over. So for me, I think that has always been something that I have really been interested in. I was fortunate enough, I got a job while I was still in grad school here at University of Houston, Clear Lake. I got a job at the Houston OCD program, which of course now is known as the McLean OCD Institute here in Houston. So while I was there, I really, you know, got a firsthand look at OCD and anxiety and anxiety disorders, phobias, BFRBs, all these, you know, disorders that I didn't really know that much about at that point. But being able to work there really gave me a lot of valuable insights. And I think, you know, while I was there, I really saw the struggle that a lot of our clients were in, but then also I was so inspired by them because, you know, ERP is hard work, you know, it's difficult. And to be able to be there for somebody who is going through that journey and working on their own exposures, it has always been just really, really inspiring to me. So my years working there just gave me a really good foundation in working with OCD and anxiety. And I knew that was the population that I wanted to work with. And that's what I've continued to do. And so up until today, now that I work in private practice, it is my favorite population to work with. I just identify with my clients so well. I'm inspired by them. I know how difficult it is. And yeah, so it that has been kind of my history professionally. And I'm happy to be part of this community. And I think there has been such a great movement these last few years, just in terms of raising awareness and getting the information out there about what OCD actually is, not just, you know, the idea that you have from media, all the TV shows and all these things. So yeah, I'm happy to be part of that and do podcasts like this and talk more about OCD. So thanks for having me.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for the explanation. What was I going to say? Yeah, so how was a question that came up for me. So when you first went to the Houston OCD clinic, or McLean now, let's say in the first sort of 6 months of working there and treating people with OCD versus say now when you work with someone with OCD, how have you grown or developed, or what do you do differently?
I think that, you know, when I first started working there, kind of the prevalent understanding of ERP and how it works was the habituation model, right? So you do exposures until your anxiety decreases and you no longer feel triggered by that situation or whatever you're working on. And I think, you know, throughout the years, I have really changed my approach in it and really kind of leaned towards the inhibitory learning model and really, you know, understanding that, you know, the habituation is not really the main focus. It's not necessarily important. We know that it doesn't happen to a lot of people. A lot of people don't habituate, but they still have really good treatment outcomes. And I think that when you go into exposures with the idea that, like, you know, I am doing this so my anxiety will decrease, a lot of people will come out from that experience feeling disappointed because they may not see their anxiety actually decrease. So I think one big shift for me has really been, you know, working with your values and really understanding that, you know, the anxiety might be there, but it doesn't have to keep you from doing the things that you love to do, the things that you want to do, the things that are important to you. And so anxiety can come along for the ride, but it doesn't have to dictate what you do and your behavior. So I think that really has been a huge shift for me since I started working with OCD up until today.
Yeah. Yeah, nice. And it's a shift from OCD. The way I look at OCD, at least in the habituation model, is it's something that's not anxiety. It's something that's bad. And now it can still be there. It's just a human experience. It's,
you know, exactly. Yeah. Anxiety itself is not a bad thing. You know, if you think about anxiety, it is a very functional emotion. Like if we think about ourselves back in the day when we were living in caves, you know, it was good to be anxious because that means like there's probably something you should be afraid of, like a snake or a tiger or something. And so anxiety itself is not a bad thing. It's just an emotion just like any other emotion. So we just need to kind of change our understanding of OC, of anxiety and being able to kind of just have it, not view it as something that's necessarily inherently bad.
Absolutely. So today we're going to talk about loved ones of people with OCD, specifically focus on them. The term loved one, when we're talking today, who are we referring to?
So loved one is anybody who is, I would say, kind of in the close circle of an OCD sufferer. So this could be a parent, it could be a spouse, it could be, you know, a friend, a child, whoever kind of lives along a person that has OCD and helps them in their journey and kind of in the day-to-day struggles that somebody with OCD might experience.
Yeah. Okay, great. And what are some of the, I'm going to start very, very broad, in your practice and over the years of working with people with OCD of different age groups, what are some of the key issues that come up between the loved one and the person with OCD?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is a really important topic to talk about because I think the loved ones really kind of, we forget about them sometimes. And I think, you know, a lot of therapists will bring the loved ones in, like the family members in the first few sessions, just to explain what OCD is, help explain what ERP is, how can the loved ones, you know, reduce their own accommodation, not give reassurance, things like this. I think that discussion is really, really important to have. But then often that's it. We kind of, you know, we focus on the OCD sufferer, of course. I mean, that's our main client that we're working with. But I think that it's important to also remember that OCD is not just an individual disorder. It does affect the whole family and the whole family unit. And so a lot of the times I think we forget all the complex emotions that can come along with being a loved one of somebody with OCD. You know, a lot of parents that I work with, they often talk about, you know, feeling guilty, like if there's something that I did or that something that I didn't do to, you know, cause my child to have OCD, a lot of anxiety in themselves, sadness, frustration, you know, those situations in the daily life when your loved one is really, or the OCD sufferer is really, you know, struggling and having a hard time resisting their rituals or asking a lot of reassurance questions and things like that. Those can be really difficult situations. And so I think a lot of loved ones, they experience this whole, you know, mix of emotions, and they may not have anybody to talk to about it. Because of course, you know, you're not going to talk to the person with OCD and say, you know, I feel really frustrated right now, just because then, you know, it sounds like you're blaming them. And of course, that's not what you want to do. And so I think that we tend to forget about the loved ones and really, you know, the complex emotions that can come along with, you know, being a loved one for somebody with OCD. And I think a lot of the times we do actually see really like caregiver burnout in, especially parents, I would say, parents of children who have OCD, because, you know, in the daily life, when you are, you know, raising a family and you might be working and there's all these daily things. And then on top of that, you know, your child has anxiety or OCD, and you are the main person that is there to help them with their rituals, help them with, you know, not giving them reassurance, not giving them any kind of accommodations. It can be a difficult position to be in. And so sometimes we forget to take care of ourselves. We just tend to focus on, you know, my loved one has OCD and I need to do all these things for them. And then we forget that we need to also take care of ourselves. And so caregiver burnout is really this state of just feeling emotionally and physically really drained and just exhausted. And that, you know, oftentimes when we forget about our own self-care and taking care of ourselves, that's where we end up. And that's a difficult position to be in. And if there is nobody there to kind of help the loved ones see that and kind of remind them of the signs that you might be experiencing caregiver burnout, this is something that might come up for you. They may not even be aware that that's a thing. So I think it's really, really important to talk about it and help recognize those signs and then talk about what can we do to prevent it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because I think in cliches most of the time, the aeroplane analogy always comes up of put your own mask on first. Mm-hmm. And yeah. if we're giving all the time, then I'll stick with the metaphor, being starved of oxygen, then we're not going to be able to help the person. What was I going to say? Yeah, so caregiver burnout. What are some of the things to look out for?
Yeah, so caregiver burnout, like I said, it is this state of just feeling really emotionally and physically drained and exhausted, really. And so somebody who is experiencing caregiver burnout, they might notice themselves, like maybe there's a shift in attitude. Like initially, you know, they were feeling all this empathy and really, you know, wanting to help their loved ones, but then that turns into just kind of feeling frustrated and maybe even resentful. And then there is really signs of depression, you know, wanting to isolate, wanting to withdraw from family and friends, having a hard time sleeping or maybe sleeping too much, maybe having different irregular habits in terms of like eating or using substances to try to manage those stress levels. So, you know, some people might kind of find themselves like feeling really lonely, feeling really isolated from other people, not having the energy or the desire to do the things that they used to enjoy. And so that can be another sign of caregiver burnout. And I think, again, like a lot of people don't really realize that this could happen. So I think it's really, really important to be aware of that and notice like when these signs are coming up, if you start to feel depressed or hopeless and frustrated and just having a hard time kind of managing daily tasks, then it's something to definitely be on the lookout for.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember, I don't know if you ever seen Unstuck, the kids OCD documentary. Mm-hmm. Chris mm-hmm. Bear, one of his daughters has OCD, and he used to go to like a parental support group of children with OCD. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that was helpful for him. So along that line, so is there anything else that you recommend or you mention to parents or loved ones of just anything like that to like mm-hmm. recharge their batteries, so to speak?
Yeah, I think the peer support is so important. And I'm really, really happy to see that there are a lot more support groups coming up. A lot more support groups, of course, for people with OCD are moving into online. And that, I think that's great because that makes it so much more accessible for a lot of people. But I do think that for loved ones, we are still getting there. We don't have as much of that peer support as we could. So I think the peer support definitely is one good thing. I think that, you know, self-care is such an important part of preventing caregiver burnout. So I think, you know, first of all, people need to remember that you are not alone in this. You don't need to do all the tasks and take on all this responsibility by yourself. Reach out for help, ask for help. Maybe seek out a therapist for yourself. I think that is always a good idea. I mean, I think everybody should be in therapy. It's not that you need a formal diagnosis or anything to be in therapy. Talking to loved ones, talking to family members, looking for, you know, support in the community, looking for support online. And I think that, you know, just speaking out about what's going on for you, what are your experiences, just helps reduce that shame and the guilt, and decrease that isolation, especially if you're feeling like you want to isolate and you don't want to see people. I think it's really, really important people remember to take time for themselves. I know sometimes it can be hard, especially for parents, to like carve out that time for themselves. And, you know, I think it's just so crucial that we take those little moments throughout the day just for yourself, you know, whatever that means for you. It might mean, you know, just going outside and sitting on the porch and drinking a cup of coffee or watching YouTube or whatever that is for you. Taking a bath, working out, getting a massage, you know, all these things that we really need just for ourselves. I think self-care, it comes in a lot of different forms. You know, mentally we can take care of ourselves, and you know, our mental well-being, I think, you know, talking to a therapist, treating ourselves with self-compassion and love, especially when we are feeling like, you know, there's something that I have done wrong, or I'm not doing this right, or all these, you know, the critical voice that often comes up, I mean, for all of us. So just remember to treat ourselves with self-compassion. Physically, you know, making sure to exercise, making sure to take care of our body, eating well, avoiding substances, just remembering to nurture your body in ways that goes to long-lasting health and well-being. Emotionally, again, remembering to reach out to others and recognize our own feelings. I think that's another thing that we tend to often just kind of, you know, push ourselves and say, okay, well, I just need to keep going, even if I'm feeling drained or exhausted. We tend to push those feelings aside, but taking the moment to actually recognize like how I'm feeling, being mindful of those emotions, I think just goes a long way. Relationally, reaching out to people, spiritually, you know, connecting with you know, a higher power, if something that is that something that you believe in, connecting with your values. Why are you actually doing this? Why is it important? And so I think just remembering those, you know, the self-care part and reminding yourself how important that is just goes a really, really long way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And so you said, I think you do like in a meeting, at least initially with loved ones to help them understand and educate them, I guess, so they can help their loved one in the home. Do you do any follow-up sessions around this side of things, the more self-care? Mm-hmm.
Yes, I do. I like to meet up with the family members. Like I said, especially with parents and also, you know, spouses, girlfriends, boyfriends. I think it's so important to just kind of bring them in and have them talk about what their experience it has been, and help them process through those things. And I always, you know, encourage them to seek a therapist for themselves. And if there are support groups in the area, I have them attend one of those. So it's definitely something that, you know, I want to keep in touch with the family members, remind them of, you know, how important it is to take care of yourself and how important it is to be on the lookout for those signs of exhaustion. So I think, you know, it is something that, like I said, it's a whole family disorder. It's not just the person with OCD. So I think it's really, really important to include all the family members and just keep up with them as well.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, the person with OCD in most cases can do ERP by themselves and get through it. But if they can bring in their housemates, their parents, their children, within reason, the system can heal much quicker than like trying to do it all on your own. I guess if you clue the family members in, then they're not in the dark. And then, because being in the dark, I'm sure has its own scary problems.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Let me look at my questions. Done that one. Okay, we'll go. Yeah, so how can a loved one feel less confused and or scared about their loved one's OCD symptoms? So I guess in the early days, you know, my loved one is doing these seemingly weird, pointless almost rituals that I don't understand why they're doing it. Yeah, how would you work with me as a loved one to just grapple my head around that?
Yeah, it is. You know, it can be really difficult to understand, especially, you know, for a person that, you know, maybe has never experienced OCD. And of course, we know that, you know, OCD kind of runs in families. You know, there's a higher prevalence rate of OCD in family members. So it is likely that, you know, maybe a parent has also had their own experiences with OCD and rituals and compulsions and things like that. And so just talking to them and helping them understand what OCD is, normalizing the experience, helping them understand that this is not something that, you know, the person is doing on purpose, you know. And I sometimes hear that too, you know, especially in the teenage years, parents might be saying like, okay, well, my kid is just acting out, and it's not something, you know, helping them just understand the nature of OCD and normalizing that, you know, this is treatable. It's absolutely treatable. It is not something that, you know, you have to suffer through alone. There is help available. And I think also being able to recognize their own triggers for loved ones. Because I, you know, everybody has those things that maybe make us feel anxious or make us feel worried. And then, you know, we can kind of model that behavior to our loved ones as well. You know, for example, with the pandemic, if parents are saying, okay, remember to wash your hands and remember to use hand sanitizer and all these things, that can absolutely raise that level of anxiety for your children as well. So just raising that awareness and understanding that, okay, you might have your own triggers as well that you need to work on, and just being aware of that, and then normalizing, helping them understand what OCD is. There's a lot of great books out there now too, for loved ones, that I always recommend, that they read. And then, you know, just helping them understand their own anxiety as well and working through that. And again, referring out to another therapist so they can have their own help and support through their own anxiety journey. And again, you know, when you were asking about like, how can they feel less scared and confused about it? I think the peer support again goes such a long way. I'm a huge supporter of peer support groups and just people finding that community where they feel heard and where they feel understood. So going online, seeking out that community, finding those other parents and loved ones who are on the same boat with you, and being able to share your story and hear other people's stories, I think it's just, it's so powerful. You know, when you feel like you're the only one, and then you speak up and you have, you know, people say, oh yeah, me too, that happens to me, and this is what I went through. It's just so, so powerful.
Yeah, it's a really good point, because I mean, I experienced that in many areas of my life, but also in OCD. And I'll see it so many times, people to do around the podcast or other stuff in the community, and they'll say, oh, I thought I was the only one. Or, you know, when they hear a symptom or an experience, it's no different for the parents, you know, because I'm sure, I keep referring to parents, it's because I'm a child and adolescent therapist, so that's where my head goes. Mm-hmm. But the loved one, the family member,
yeah,
they probably feel, you know, isolated. This is only happening in my family. No one else is experiencing this. Mm-hmm. And then, as you said, the peer support with other peers, and they think, oh, actually, no, their family is exactly the same, or whatever it is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, shame is a social emotion, right? Like, we would not feel shame if we were alone in a deserted island, right? True. But when we are experiencing something, and then we have that idea in our heads that, like, nobody else is going through this, this is only me, you know, there's something wrong with me, I have done something wrong, that's when you feel shame. But then, you know, the cure, if you will, for shame is also social. So being able to speak up and talk to other people and get that experience of, like, oh yeah, like, I'm definitely not alone in this. I see and hear all these stories of other people going through the exact same thing, and that just lifts the weight off your shoulder.
Yeah. Is it, you can't live in darkness. As soon as you shine a light on it, it goes. The other one is another cure then for shame, is just live on a deserted island. That's that will fix your problem. Okay, so you mentioned a couple of books actually, did you want to sort of name drop them if you have them to mind?
So there is Loving Someone with OCD, of course, that's a classic. And then Dr. Abramovich just came up with another. I believe you interviewed him too, about his book.
Getting over OCD. No, so it's families in the title. I don't know if you can remember.
Yes. Yeah. I see the book cover in my mind, but yeah, I think it's Getting Over Your Loved One's OCD. It's a great book. I think, you know, those two books are always something that, you know, I recommend.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll put the link in the show notes. And there's also John Hirschfield's one, When a Family Member Has OCD.
Yes. That's another good one.
Okay. So it might be worth just talking about accommodation for a bit. Obviously, this doesn't necessarily tie into a caregiver burden, anything like this, but obviously getting the family system to work together for both the person with OCD. And obviously, if that starts to go smoothly, then it's, I guess, going to be less of an emotional strain on the loved one anyway. So I guess just briefly summarize, like, what is family accommodation and why is it not helpful?
Sure. Yeah. So family accommodation is really anything that the family does to modify their daily life and their daily habits to accommodate for the loved one's OCD. So let's say, you know, a child, for example, is washing their hands in the morning and they're having a hard time getting to breakfast. So then everybody else is waiting before they start breakfast, or, you know, just kind of modifying the schedule and the routine in the morning to accommodate, to wait for the loved one. It could mean, you know, giving reassurance. If the OCD sufferer is asking for repeated questions like, do you love me? Is something bad going to happen? Did I just hit someone with my car? Giving those answers, you know, if your loved one is sending you pictures of the stove and asking, like, is it off? Is the house going to be okay when I leave? Giving that reassurance, saying, yes, it's off. It could mean, you know, like I said, changing anything in your daily life. Maybe, you know, your child calls you, they're really, really anxious at school, you go pick them up, you leave work to pick them up early. So family accommodation is anything that we do with our own behavior to accommodate for our loved one with OCD. And we know that it's not helpful. We know that it feeds into the OCD cycle because, you know, we are, first of all, giving them the signal that you cannot handle your anxiety. Like somebody needs to jump in and rescue you, or, you know, gives them the idea that the rituals are helpful and necessary for you to be able to get through this, this experience that you're going through right now. And so it just feeds the OCD cycle. We just feed the anxiety, we feed the OCD. And we know, of course, we know that the rituals help in the short term. It makes you feel better right then and there. Your anxiety is going to start to decrease. But then the next moment there's a trigger and you feel anxious, the family is going to be there, you know, needing to accommodate and do something again to help the anxiety to come down. And it's probably going to, you know, get more and more of that time and effort to do those accommodations over time when the triggers just kind of accumulate and there's more and more things that make the person feel anxious. So in the long term, it's not a good solution. It actually just makes the situation worse. So that's why we want to talk to family members about accommodation and make sure that they understand that this is not a good long-term solution. It has worked for you maybe in the short term, but it is not helping you. It's actually hurting your loved one. And that's why we need to start reducing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess what came to me to tie it back to the theme of this episode is initially, at least when, or even as you go up, if you do a hierarchy, so go up the hierarchy, if you say to your client, you know, you need to start reducing asking for reassurance or whatever it is, or saying to the parent or the spouse, you need to stop buying the extra large bottle of shampoo, you know, you need to go back to the regular size, whatever it is. Changing that behavior is going to be, because obviously as a parent, a loved one, a spouse, you want to care for that person. You don't want to see them distressed. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you take away that big bottle of shampoo, all the reassurance giving, you're going to see them most likely be distressed. And that is then an emotional burden back on the loved one. Yeah. But we know that that's the direction we need to head. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you say around that to them or help them understand to stick with it?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think we do need to prep the family members and the loved ones and say, like, this is going to be a difficult journey. And it, you know, when we first start to reduce the accommodations, you are going to notice that intense anxiety. And maybe, you know, there is going to be an increase in asking for the accommodations and maybe asking for reassurance. Mm-hmm. But just remembering that, you know, we're working for the good, for the long term, you know, it just making sure that they really understand that the accommodations do not work in the future. It's only going to make your loved one feel better right here. But as you know, you have noticed, otherwise they wouldn't be, you know, in the therapy room, they wouldn't ask for help. You have noticed that it really doesn't help in the long term. It doesn't help in the day to day. And so prepping them for that and making sure that they understand that, like, you are doing the right thing, even though it might feel that you are somehow, you know, torturing your loved one. Like, it's not your fault. It's a natural process that they will notice their anxiety increase and it's a difficult process, but also remembering that the reward is going to be at the end of the tunnel if you can stick with the process. And I think that's exactly where we need to support the loved ones and help them, you know, with that emotion, because it can be really, really intense to see your loved one suffer. And of course, you know, the only thing you want to do is make them feel better. So the step to reducing those accommodations sometimes can be really high, because we don't want to see our loved ones suffer. Of course we don't. And so just making sure that they really understand the rationale and remember that what we're working towards here.
Yeah, absolutely. And what came to me then was in saying that, you know, when you start to refrain from giving reassurance or enabling compulsions in any way, you're no doubt going to feel anxious as the mm-hmm. loved one. Mm-hmm. That's insight into how you're the person with OCD is feeling, and that can mm-hmm. also then link into connecting, mm-hmm. understanding, I guess, a bit better. Mm-hmm. Okay, so obviously, while I've got you here, is there thinking about how we can get the loved one and the person with OCD working together better? Because if that happens, in theory, everyone is better off, hopefully. So yeah, is there anything? So a large portion of my audience are people directly with OCD. I do have mm-hmm. a lot of loved ones listening and therapists, mm-hmm. but the bulk mm-hmm. of it is people with OCD. So is there anything they can do to help, I don't necessarily help their loved one, but help their loved one help them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So sometimes, you know, a person with OCD, they may not be ready to go through the ERP journey. Maybe they're not at the point where they really feel like they need help, or, you know, it can be really, really scary to take that first step. But then you might have the loved ones coming into therapy and say, like, I really want to help them. I don't know what to do. I've been doing all these accommodations. I've been giving all this reassurance and I see it's not working. What can I do? Mm-hmm. And so we can really work with the family members. We can work with the loved ones. Again, just explaining to them what the OCD is, how it works, how the OCD cycle functions, and then helping them modify their own behavior in a way that you are slowly taking away the reassurance and all the accommodations. So that kind of gives the authority to the person with OCD, because now they are in the position where, okay, I am dealing with a lot more anxiety. I am dealing with maybe having to do more things for myself. How am I going to deal with this? Am I going to isolate, or am I going to take the step to really start doing these things that are difficult for me? And, you know, then the family members can be there to really support them and cheer them on and say, hey, I know this is really difficult for you. I can see you're really triggered. I can see you're really, really anxious right now. And I know you can do it. I know that you are strong and you can handle the anxiety. And I'm here for you. So I think that, you know, even, you know, if the person with OCD is not ready to take that first initial step to come into treatment and do ERP, we can absolutely work with the family so they can learn how they can modify their own behavior for the long-term benefits, and not just the short-term quick fixes and band-aids.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I guess if they are ready for therapy, the word that came to my mind was like teamwork. So see it as, I need to get my loved ones on side here. I need to work with them, not against them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Taking OCD is the enemy, not, yes. You know, we are in this, we are a team together battling OCD, you know, not like we are, you know, somehow against each other or, you know, battling each other, but like the common enemy here is OCD, and let's work towards that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was all my questions on this topic. Is there anything else we've missed that you want to share?
Well, I think that I briefly touched on it, but I think self-compassion is such a huge part of for all of us. I think, you know, anybody can use a more compassionate, caring attitude towards themselves. But I think especially when we talk about loved ones, a lot of the times with all those complex emotions, feeling guilty and feeling like ashamed and something, you know, there's something that I have done wrong to cause this to happen, or I don't know how to deal with this. Again, we tend to feel that isolation. And then when we feel isolated, we tend to feel really harsh and critical towards ourselves. And so I think self-compassion is something that, again, we need to remind the loved ones to treat themselves with self-compassion. And be kind to themselves. And of course, self-care is part of that. And of course, what we know, you know, with research that Kristen Neff has done with self-compassion, we know all the different parts of it. And mindfulness is a huge part of self-compassion. So just being able to, you know, be present with your experience, be present with the critic that's going on in your head and saying there's something wrong with you, and you know, there's, you know, you have some done something to cause this and you don't know what you're doing, being able to take a step back and recognize like, okay, there's that critical voice is going on again, but I don't need to buy into it. I don't need to necessarily believe in it. It's not helpful for me right now to listen to that. And I think also, you know, with mindfulness, being able to recognize your emotions, just like I was saying earlier, not pushing them away, not trying to dismiss how you're feeling, but rather giving yourself permission to say like, this is really hard. This is really, really difficult. Like I'm having a hard time, you know, being there for my loved one. I'm having a hard time taking care of myself. It's a difficult situation. And just being able to recognize that and allow yourself to suffer, really. And then, of course, remembering that common humanity piece and reminding yourself that you're not alone. Everybody suffers. Everybody goes through difficulties, even if it isn't exactly what you're going through. But all, you know, all the humans on this earth have felt fear and sadness and shame and all these other complex emotions before, and you are definitely not alone in it. And then just, of course, remembering the self-kindness piece and, you know, treating yourself with kindness and compassion. I think, you know, loved ones oftentimes have an easier time giving that compassion and care and understanding to other people, the people around them. But then for some reason, when it comes to ourselves, we don't apply that same compassion and care. You know, it's as if we don't deserve it, or it's as if somehow, you know, being hard on ourselves makes us push ourselves harder and then and makes us feel motivated, but it's actually the opposite. So just remember that, like, you also are worthy of that compassion and care and love, and treating yourself just like you treat your loved ones and your family members and your best friends. I think that just self-compassion is such a huge piece.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And what I thought of was that I can't remember where I read it, but there was some data which showed that the amount of prescriptions collected, I'm forgetting the word, anyway, for varying different medicines. And it was something like when it was collecting medicine for like our dog or for a loved one, we almost never failed to pick it up. But the amount of medicine that's basically left on the shelf for yourself is quite a lot, because I think that just kind of shows what you were saying. We forget ourselves and don't think we're as special. We don't take as much care as we would a dog or a loved one. Or
Exactly. Yeah. And that's when you end up in having caregiver burnout, because you completely forget about yourself and you completely dismiss your own needs. And you find yourself in this place who's just feeling exhausted and hopeless. So I think it's just really, really important to start applying these tools before you get to that point where you feel like you just feel really, really exhausted. So, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, good points. So I often ask sort of like words of hope, but let's tailor that to any loved ones listening, because I'm sure that they may feel this is never going to get better for my loved one. It's going to be tough in the family, et cetera, et cetera. What would you tell them? In terms of words of hope,
I would tell them absolutely, you know, 100%, you're not alone in this. You don't have to go through this alone. We, you know, therapists, we are here to help you as well as the person with OCD. We are a team together working on this. There is a whole community out there ready to support you, ready to help you. Definitely, you're not alone. And there is hope. You know, we know that OCD is very treatable. You know, research has proven it. We've seen it time and time again. And so right now, even though it seems like there is no hope and it's not going to get better, just know that this is just one moment and things will get better. And so just remembering that you are not alone in this, and help is out there. Just being able to seek out that help.
Yeah, absolutely. And then slight change of direction now. So amongst your clients, what is there anything you notice, any patterns or mindsets or anything about those that kind of seem to make progress quicker than others?
Let's see. I think that, you know, ERP is a difficult process. It definitely takes a lot of willpower, really, because it's hard. It's really, really difficult to put yourself in a situation where you deliberately, you know, feel anxious and then, you know, not doing anything about it, but just sitting with it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of the times there might be that initial just fear of, I don't think I can sit with that anxiety. I don't think I can face my triggers and my fears. But I think that, you know, that's why a very skilled OCD therapist comes in and helps them take that first initial step, however small it is, so that, you know, people can get that first experience of like, oh, like, I actually can, like, this is really cool. And I think when people get that experience of feeling empowered and noticing that, like, hey, you know, I am stronger than I think I am, that's when people start to really do well in treatment. But I think sometimes people just don't have, when they first come in, they don't have that, maybe they don't believe in themselves. They don't really believe that I could do this. But that's why you work with somebody who is skilled in treating OCD, can show you like all the smallest steps that we can start to get to that point where you notice that like you actually can, you are stronger than you think. So then I think that at that point you start to see people getting better and better when they feel that sense of pride and self-efficacy. Like I am here and I can do this myself and with the help of my therapist.
Yeah.
So I think it's just that first step, even though it's super intimidating and scary to take that first step. But if we can get to that point, that's when we see people just start to get better really quickly.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah, that kind of going from I've read about ERP, I know it can help, versus I've now seen and felt that the change and that it can help.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, getting that experience for yourself and actually noticing what it's like, firsthand experiencing that it does work, then that's when you have somebody who is a believer and they want to move forward.
Okay so you can pick up the phone and call 20-year-old Ava. What do you tell her?
Oh gosh, I knew this question was coming. Well, I would tell her that you don't have to worry as much. You know, things always have a way of working out. You can, you know, you worrying about things beforehand is not going to change the outcome of what's actually going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And if something bad does happen, then we can deal with it in the moment. But you ruminating about it and worrying about it is not going to help you in any way.
No.
So I think that would be the biggest piece of advice I would give myself. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. And I'm sure you know the next one. You got a billboard. What do you want written on that billboard?
I would just write to right up there and say, you are not alone. That is such a huge, and I think, you know, you might see that somewhere, but really understanding that like you are not alone in whatever you're going through. There's so many of us out there that have been where you are, feeling the emotions that you are feeling. And, you know, we are here for you. You know, we are all on this earth together and this collective humanness that, you know, we are all experiencing, and just reminding yourself that you're not alone on this.
Yeah, absolutely. And then lastly, anything else you could have shared today, or you wanted to share, I should say?
Yeah. Well, one thing that I didn't, when you were asking about kind of how to, I guess, how when you see the people that get better, I think one thing that people really need to also experience and you know, look within themselves is the values piece. Like, why am I doing this work? you know, if you come into treatment with the purpose of, I don't want to feel anxious, then that's probably not going to take you very far. Because like we talked about earlier, anxiety is part of life. We can't really make that feeling go away. So what do you want to pursue while you are feeling anxious? Are you willing to have that anxiety for, you know, for the things that you love, for the things that are important and valuable to you? So I always pair ERP with values work. I always want to talk to my clients about, why are we doing this? Why do you want to go through with feeling uncomfortable and feeling anxious? What is the purpose of this? So, you know, is it so that later on you can, you know, spend time with your family, play with your kids without, you know, feeling like you need to isolate yourself from them, or, you know, not be around them because you're having intrusive thoughts? Or is it for, you know, the love of learning? Is it something that, you know, what would you be doing if you didn't have OCD and anxiety? And I think once people are able to connect with the values piece of, what can I gain from this? What can I be doing? That's also when you see people like really clicking and starting to pursue those things, even if it is difficult, even if they feel anxious.
Yeah, absolutely. Is it, Nietzsche said, he who has a why can bear almost any how. I think that's,
yeah.
I think I said that right. Yeah.
That's so true.
Nice. No, great way to end. And look, thank you so much for your time. I've learned a lot, and I'm sure the listeners have too.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This is great.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. Thanks also to NoCD for sponsoring the show. For more information, please click the link in the episode description. A quick disclaimer, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.